And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper handy so that if there's something that you want to write down, you're going to be able to do that, because I assure you that there's some addresses, web routes, things like that, that you may want to refer to later. So have that pencil and paper handy. Pay attention. All this stuff means something. No Pipelines Training Camp is coming up in the Pacific Northwest, April 4th through 6th. And got this off the Earth First Newswire. Rising Tide is organizing a convergence weekend, April 4th, 5th, and 6th, called No Pipelines Action Training for Climate Justice. The location will be announced later. This weekend will be for mass movement trainings focused on building resistance across our different organizing spaces to fight extreme energy expansion in its numerous resulting oppressions across Turtle Island. We'd like to invite you, your collective group organization, to this event so we can learn from one another and strengthen our resolve to stop the expansion of extreme energy and the exploitation of human and natural resources, and offer our support to communities on the front lines of the ecological crisis. The place to write to is risingtide604@riseup.net. That's risingtide604@riseup.net. And once again, dates for No Pipelines Action Training Camp will be held April 4th, 5th, and 6th in and around Vancouver, and I believe that's British Columbia. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife is to hold some teleconference hearings on wolves on October 12th. Let me say that again. On October 2012, the gray wolf became a candidate species for listing under the California Endangered Species Act. However, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has recommended to the commission that they not list the gray wolf as endangered. The California Fish and Game Commission will hold a special teleconference. The agenda includes a public forum where members of the public can comment to the commission on any topic within its jurisdiction. The commission is set to decide whether or not to list the gray wolf as endangered in California after the Environmental Protection Information Center and the Center for Biological Diversity submitted a listing petition to the commission in 2012. This teleconference presents a perfect opportunity for public members who cannot make it to the April 16th, 2014 commission meeting in Ventura to tell the commission you support listing the gray wolf as endangered in California. Members of the public are encouraged to attend the teleconference locations and tell the commission you support listing gray wolves as endangered. The public can attend and make comments at the following offices: Department of Fish and Wildlife, 50 Erickson Court, Arcata, California. Department of Fish and Wildlife, 20 Lower Ragsdale Drive, Suite 100, Monterey, California. Department of Fish and Wildlife, 1933 Cliff Drive, Suite 9, Santa Barbara, California, and the Baldwin Hills Scenic Overlook Ranger Station, 6300 Hetzler Road, Culver City, California. Once again, the date isn't listed. Oh boy, I'm going to have to figure that out. But it's coming up in March here. Let me figure out when that is and get back to you. Anyway, for further information, go to www.wildcalifornia.org. Somehow I missed the date. Southern ocean whales are safe for now. Whaling is over for 2014. Sea Shepherd is proud to announce the Japanese whaling fleet has left the waters of the Antarctic Treaty Zone, ending whale poaching in the Southern Whale Sanctuary for this year. Today at approximately 0215 Australian Eastern Daylight Time, the automatic identification system signal of the Nishin Maru was picked up shortly before the factory vessel of the Japanese whaling fleet crossed 60 degrees south. It can be confirmed that the vessel is on a northerly course, traveling approximately 10 to 11 knots, with its destination set for Japan, and arrival scheduled in approximately 3 weeks. Since the Nishin Maru was last seen fleeing on March 2nd, the Bob Barker and the Steve Irwin have swept across and occupied the only good weather areas that were available to the whale poachers this late in the season. During this time, the Nishin Maru has been accompanied by only one harpoon ship. This further hampered the ability of the whalers, adding to the woes of their already disastrous season. On Tuesday, the Yushin Maru No. 2 and the Yushin Maru No. 3 harpoon ships began dropping away from their positions, tailing the Sea Shepherd conservation ships, indicating that the whalers were low on fuel and unable to tail the Sea Shepherd ships any further. The Bob Barker and Steve Irwin then began running northwards towards the boundary of the Atlantic Treaty Zone hope to push the Nisshin Maru out of the whale sanctuary. In the decade of Sea Shepherd's Antarctic whale defense campaigns, this is the first time the whalers have activated their AIS while still being in their self-allotted whaling grounds, having always kept their location secret in order to avoid interception by the Sea Shepherd conservation ships. Captain Siddharth Chakravarti of the Steve Irwin says, by giving away their location and intent to return to Japan, the whalers are signaling certain surrender. Wanting to avoid further chase by Sea Shepherd would lead them into massive Southern Ocean swells forecasted as large as 10 meters, that's about 33 feet, and further embarrassment at being located by our ships once again. They have been left no choice but to run and abandon their hunt. I am immensely proud of our efforts, keeping the whalers on the run and disrupting illegal operations for the entire whaling season. Since first locating the whale poachers on January 5th, the Sea Shepherd fleet has actively pursued the Japanese whalers, locating the Nisshin Maru on a record 4 separate occasions over the 3-month period. The whaling fleet's operations were hampered by Sea Shepherd's continual pursuit, which included twice exposing the whalers to the process of butchering protected minke whales poached from the waters of the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. This is the latest that the Sea Shepherd fleet has remained in the Southern Ocean to intervene against illegal operations of the whalers. Captain Peter Hammerstedt of the Bob Barker said, the late departure of the whaling fleet is a testament to the fact that they have been delivered a disastrous season by the hand of Sea Shepherd, willing to push into the second week of March despite deteriorating weather conditions rather than face our fleet. Before we started this campaign, we made a promise to our clients, the whales, and to all of our supporters around the world to drive these poachers out of the whales' waters. We have kept that promise. We are relentless. The Sam Simon returned to their home port of Williamson, Melbourne, Australia, on Saturday to a hero's welcome. The Bob Barker is now en route to Wellington. The Steve Irwin will return to Hobart to honor Sea Shepherd chairman and co-campaign leader for Operation Restless, Bob Brown. Both ships are scheduled to return around March 22nd. Sea Shepherd remains the only organization committed to upholding the sanctity of the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary, directly intervening against the illegal operations of the Japanese whaling fleet. For further information, go to their webpage, www.seashepherd.org.au. That's www.seashepherd.org.au. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. The day after Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer Humphrey Jacobs blocked the road to Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap, the Park Service issued their first and only bison operations press release of the year, announcing that the trap was empty and capture operations had ceased for the season. Treaty hunting, however, continues in the Gardner Basin outside of Yellowstone's northern boundary. Another 24 buffalo were killed by hunters since we last wrote. 5 of these buffalo were adult cows, likely pregnant, and already caring for a yearling. Hundreds of buffalo have migrated south, heading deeper into Yellowstone and away from danger. But their troubles are far from over. We have had a significant winter this year with heavy amounts of snow. Temperatures have grown unseasonably warm for March, which means the snow has been melting in the daytime and freezing hard during the night, making it very difficult for buffalo to travel or crater through to the grasses below. Consequently, we anticipate winter kills will be high this year. Weather alone is a formidable challenger, but buffalo have evolved and thrived through ice ages, but they continue to pay a heavy price for the intolerance and misunderstandings of the human race. Unless we change, they may not survive. With incredible patience and seeming forgiveness, they press on in grace and persistence to live wild and free, resistance to oppression, and an uncanny endurance to carry on. On Tuesday, Humphrey appeared in court where he was offered a plea bargain, which he did not accept. He has a second arraignment scheduled for April 2nd. Humphrey will have significant restitution and court fines to pay, and sincerely appreciates all of the offers many of you have made to help with these costs. Montana Supreme Court issued an opinion Wednesday afternoon upholding Judge Phillips' ruling in the Gardner Basin bison case, which Park County had appealed. Wild bison get to access the habitat that Buffalo Field Campaign, Earth Justice, and other bison advocates, and even the state of Montana argued for them to roam in the Gardner Basin. The court concluded that Park County could not raise on appeal a claim they didn't raise initially. Park County's appeal was dismissed, and this case is over. The Gardner Area Habitat Expansion is not a solution to the serious challenges wild bison face in Montana, nor does it stop the slaughter. Mature bull bison will benefit. Mixed cow-calf family groups are not afforded the same tolerance. The new habitat available is seasonal, allowing bison to use portions of the Gardner Basin for a few months. Hunting pressures have increased along with this expanded habitat, and hazing of all wild bison in the Gardner Basin will resume every spring. Because this was a state case, it does not stop Yellowstone National Park's capture and slaughter plans. Indeed, wild buffalo have barely been able to use the 75,000 acres of habitat they have been granted due to the park's buffalo capture and slaughter operation and hunting just outside of Yellowstone's boundary. Had any of the park counties claimed survived, conditions would be far worse for any wild buffalo in Montana, as there would be none at all with the court's sanctions. Thank you to attorneys Summer Nelson and Ted Fellman and Buffalo Field Campaign's Habitat Coordinator Daryl Geist for your persistence in representing wild buffalo in this case. Thanks also to all of the pro-buffalo local residents, among them Fred Baker and Scott Hungshausen. Your voices were an important antidote to the complaints of the vocal anti-buffalo minority. This decision is a cause and reason to press on until wild bison are roaming free throughout their native Montana again. Anyway, the Buffalo Field Campaign could use some volunteers. If you'd like to volunteer, go visit their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and check out what's going on. They also need equipment, so if you can supply any of that or money, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. And once again, visit the Buffalo Field Campaign's website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And Yosemite bears are turning into health nuts with junk food off the menu in this story by Alex Dubaczynski, editing by Cynthia Johnson and Andrew Hay of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. Bears in Yosemite National Park in California have adopted the wildlife version of a health food diet after increased safety measures largely blocked them from scavenging for food in campgrounds over the last 15 years, a recent study has shown. An estimated 350 to 400 black bears roam Yosemite, one of the most popular U.S. tourist destinations. Interaction between the park's bears and people reached a record level in 1998 as the animals raided campgrounds and broke into cars in search of groceries and leftovers, according to Yosemite spokesman Scott Geideman. After recording 1,584 human-bear interactions that year, the park east of San Francisco adopted a policy in 1999 that included placing bear-resistant food storage containers in campgrounds and cracking down more forcefully on people leaving out items like chips or bread, Geideman said. The initiative seems to have paid off in the park, where waterfalls and sequoia trees draw tourists from around the globe. A research paper in this month's edition of the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment found a 63% drop in the proportion of human food in the diet of Yosemite's bears. The animals now eat the same amount of human food as they did in 1915, when the park had few thousand visitors annually compared to the current count of 4 million people a year, the study suggested. The number of bear-human interactions has also dropped dramatically to just 155 in 2012, Gitterman said. That comes as the park's approach to wildlife management has evolved dramatically since the park was created in 1890, as rangers began recognizing the need to keep bears away from people. For decades, until the mid-1960s, rangers would feed bears in open areas and allow visitors to sit in bleachers to watch the spectacle, Gettleman said. It was entertainment. Jack Hopkins, a fellow researcher at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who led the study, said he traced how much human food bears were consuming by stringing up barbed wire in the park to snag hair from animals. The study analyzed the hair, comparing it to bones from bears that inhabited the park around 1915 and in later decades. Researchers looking for certain types of nitrogen and carbon isotopes in the hair and bones to determine how much human food they were consuming, since those isotopes are indicative of human-like food. The analysis showed Yosemite bears were eating 63% less human food in the period after the new policies were put in place than between 1975 and 1985, a period during which some bears were consuming more human food than at any other time previously recorded. Bears and people have heavy carbon isotopes in their tissues because corn has a heavy signature. Among the many downsides of human food consumption for bears is that they may suffer from rotting teeth because of the high sugar content of the pilfered chow, Hopkins said. Furthermore, a bear hooked on human food will keep coming back, putting both humans and bears at risk, he said. One of the big things is to put more focus into prevention management, take care of the problem at its root, which is removing human food from the landscape and keeping it in a place where animals cannot get to it. As Yosemite officials have succeeded in keeping human food away from bears, rangers now are forced to kill only one or two animals a year compared to the seven or eight they shot each year in the 1990s, Getterman said. And the jaguar has received 764,000 acres in the United States Southwest, and that includes the Rosemont Mine area. In this story by Paul Ingram and Daniela Millar of the Tucson Sentinel, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A federal agency labeled more than 764,000 acres in southeastern Arizona and southwestern New Mexico on as habitat critical to protecting the endangered northern jaguar. Designated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the area covers mountain ranges throughout Pima, Cochise, and Santa Cruz counties, as well as ranges in Hidalgo County, New Mexico. The area was reduced from an earlier proposal of 838,000 acres because Fort Huachuca and the Tohono O'odham Nation were excluded from the designation. The designation is part of a long-standing series of lawsuits between the Center for Biological Diversity, a Tucson-based environmental organization, and the agency. CBD spokesperson Michael Robinson said the group expects Fish and Wildlife to produce a draft recovery plan this spring, but the agency has been reluctant to create habitat designations. Tuesday's announcement says that the federal agencies will have to consider the impact on jaguars before approving uses such as mining. The designation doesn't apply to private land unless the owners propose a use requiring federal funding or permits. It serves as a yellow flag for federal agencies that now have an additional responsibility to protect the habitat, said Jeff Humphrey of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The habitat designation could make it more difficult for the proposed Rosemont mine to win federal approval. While Fish and Wildlife has stated the mine's use of 5,000 acres in the Santa Rita Mountains would not be forbidden under habitat protection rules, environmental groups will challenge this finding. And boreal forest shifts sink to source with rising temperatures in this story by Tom Spears of the Ottawa Citizen. The immense forests of Canada's north, relied on as a natural way to soak up greenhouse gases, are threatening to become a major emitter of these gases instead. Canada has told the world for years that our forests help soak up carbon dioxide and store carbon. The argument is that this cancels out some emissions from our cars, homes, and industries, but this is already shifting in the boreal forest, covering 3 million square kilometers in Newfoundland to the Yukon. The wide-ranging review of forest climate in this area says that dead trees will rot as the temperature rises instead of being stored as peat, releasing carbon dioxide and methane. Both are greenhouse gases, as well a greater number of forest fires will release even more carbon dioxide. Large sea carbon stocks have accumulated in the boreal forest because decomposition is limited by cold temperatures and often anoxic environments that are low on oxygen. Increases in temperatures and disturbance rates could result in a large net sea source during the remainder of this century and beyond, the paper from the Natural Resources Canada said. While not a sure bet, the shift is seen as having a strong chance and would affect world levels of carbon dioxide. This conclusion is just one element of five sweeping new studies of how climate change affects Canada's 3 million square kilometers of boreal forest. Nine more are still to be published. All came from Natural Resources Canada. Rather than presenting new research, they summarize the most current information available about boreal forests in Canada and elsewhere. They are printed in Environmental Reviews, a science journal published in Ottawa by the NRC Research Press. Editor John Small says these are consequences of global warming that people often don't think about, and these are all in our backyard. That's a big worrying factor, Small said, of the forest shift from soaking up greenhouse gases to emitting them. What happens if you get more forest fires? What happens if wetlands dry out and stop accumulating peat and then start decomposing? That's a big concern, Small said. The package of reviews provides a big picture of the boreal region that Parliament and forest managers will need to understand. The overview forecasts a rise of 2 degrees Celsius by 2050, 4.5 degrees Celsius by 2100. Among the other predictions, more pests The most immediate threats may be the rapid expansion of populations of endemic pest species, including budworm defoliators and spruce bark beetles, in years when critical temperature thresholds are exceeded. Risks of widespread tree diseases may also exist but remain largely unquantified. More fires. Forest fires will likely increase gradually in terms of occurrence, area burn, and severity over the next few decades. Melting permafrost. There have been warnings about melting permafrost for years, but the report now concludes that much of this melting is irreversible. A major concern must be that some 40% of the present-day boreal forest overlays permafrost. These ecosystems are particularly vulnerable to permafrost degradation, which is already widespread and expected to expand rapidly in response to warming trends that have already begun. Once an area melts, it takes several decades before the soil readjusts and new trees can grow, it says. The process of degradation will occur on a vast scale, causing the release of even more greenhouse gases for a period lasting well into the 22nd century, the authors write. Western drought. Warmer temperatures and drought are likely in western Canada, with the potential for large-scale diebacks of commercially important tree species in central Alberta and Saskatchewan. Natural recolonization by more drought-tolerant species may be possible, but that will be a comparatively slow process. But from the Great Lakes east, the long-range forecast shows more rain, so these forests could grow faster in warmer temperatures. Lakes and rivers. 13% of the forest area is water. Lakes are downhill, so what happens in the ecosystem affects lakes, Small said. If different tree species move in, it could affect the water quality. If you have forest fires, it could affect water quality. The natural resources analysis says that warmer forests will attract more logging and mining, which also could cause more water pollution. And a Salmon win a court ruling that sets aside a Marin countywide plan, in this story by Nels Johnson of the Marin Independent Journal. In a sharply critical decision that leaves Marin's planning department in legal limbo, an appellate court ordered more analysis of how development affects San Geronimo Valley's endangered coho salmon. The ruling by the First District Court of Appeal in San Francisco reversed a Marin Superior Court decision, sets aside a 2007 countywide plan and its environmental report pending study of the impacts of creekside building on salmon, and declared that a building ban was improperly imposed in San Geronimo Valley. What is missing in the present case is a meaningful analysis of the likely cumulative impacts of a widespread build-out, regardless of the details of individual projects, the court said, adding neither the countywide plan nor its environmental impact report go far enough in evaluating how creekside construction affects streams. The report fails to estimate the maximum potential impact, the range of potential impacts, or the likely net impact of Marin's countywide planning policies. Fishery activists at the Salmon Protection and Watershed Network of Forest Knolls, which contested county compliance with state environmental law and sued to get tougher creekside building rules, hailed the ruling as a triumph. We hope that after this decision, county supervisors are ready to work together so we can save these species from extinction, said Todd Steiner, head of the Salmon Network. The judges agreed with Spahn that the county acted unlawfully because the environmental impact report provides no help in decision makers or the public to understand the likely consequences of allowable build-out, said Deborah Sivas of Stanford Law School's Environmental Clinic, which represented the Salmon Network along with attorney Michael Graff. Without proper analysis, the court explained, the county cannot make informed judgments about the advisability of future development and its impacts on salmon, she said. The appellate court found a building ban was improperly imposed by Marin Superior Court Judge Lynn Durie, and Kinsey asserted officials can't protect the salmon without unfairly penalizing existing homeowners, and the court's permission to continue processing permits in the San Geronimo Valley reinforces that. Supervisor Steve Kinsey said he trusted the work of the Marin County Community Development Department, which oversees planning policies and environmental analyses, including stream and salmon programs. Top officials were not immediately available for comment on the ruling. Supervisor Susan Adams saying protection of sensitive habitat has been a primary concern for the county since the first general plan in 1972, noted the county has worked hard to nurture the fishery. It would be unfortunate if the court decision threw us back to the 1994 general plan, which will be in effect while the 2007 plan is set aside, and not take advantage of the work that has been done by a number of environmental groups and residents since then, she said. Although an initial footnote in the 25-page ruling cites a stipulation limiting the case to the way the countywide plan applies to Geronimo Valley, the unanimous appellate court concludes with a final disposition that does not mention the limitation. The disposition ordered the county to set aside its approval of the 2007 countywide plan and certification of the related environmental impact report until new environmental studies assess the cumulative future impact of that development may have. We conclude that the EIR is deficient and that the injunction should not have been entered, the court said. And let's turn to some biological diversity news. Texas salamanders get Endangered Species Act protection. Two Central Texas salamanders are the latest animals to benefit from the Center for Biological Diversity's historic agreement to speed up protection for 757 species. The Georgetown and Salado salamanders have been on the waiting list for protection for years and need clean, well-oxygenated water to survive. They're threatened by pollution, habitat disturbance, and a growing human population. Saving these salamanders will also protect the precious springs that give drinking water and recreation to Texas communities, said Colette Adkins Geis, a center attorney and biologist who works to save imperiled amphibians and reptiles. The 757 species agreement has already yielded Endangered Species Act protection for 107 species and proposed protections for another 28. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update. If you want to listen to a rebroadcast of this Earth First Update, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Or if you live in Moscow, Idaho, you can tune in Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, is now heard on 90.3 FM, their new high-power frequency. And you can also get updates at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. You can find podcasts and listen by downloading the show there. I do want to add that radioforall.net is in serious financial trouble, and to continue to get the Earth First Update and many other shows through radioforall.net, they're putting out an urgent call for money. Money is the root of all great progressive radio, and one of the ways that progressive radio producers like myself and others distribute their programs to other radio stations is by means of radioforall.net. They've managed to move their servers out of the place that was about to confiscate them, and after a few hours of being off the air earlier this week, they have managed to get their main server back up on the air, and I believe the archive is also working, though it will probably be very slow. So please, if you want to support sort of the backbone of progressive radio and Free Radio Santa Cruz, go to radioforall.net, and up in the upper right-hand corner is a little place where you can find out how to donate and support them. Earth First Radio and the Earth First Update will be back next week. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.